Comrades, we often talk about the fact that the Russian Revolution is probably the most slandered event in newer history. But I think there's no doubt that the most distorted event, the most distorted revolution ever, is probably the Iranian Revolution of 1979. The legacy of the revolution has been distorted to such a manner that it is difficult to find anything, any real information about the revolution. These distortions goes from the distortions of the bourgeois intellectuals, and through all the writings of all the left groupings and the workers' movement. By the bourgeois, the revolution is portrayed as the Islamic revolution, where the backward people of Iran rose in order to install a medieval system of the most vicious, inhumane oppression. And the revolution, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, has been used as a way to as a ram to justify the so-called theory of the clash of civilizations, to which the bourgeois still cling on. I think there's just as many histories of the Iranian Revolution as there are historians that have written the books. In reality, what happened between the years of 1977 and 1983 was a genuine people's revolution. It was a social revolution that was drowned in blood and betrayed by every single of his leaders. And in the end, Khomeini, who was a populist, demagogic Bonapartist, leaning on different classes, rose up as the executioner of the Iranian Revolution. Now, before we get to the revolution itself, I would like to tell some historical background. Iran as a country emerged late onto the scene of world capitalism. And in fact, capitalism never really, to any significant degree, developed of itself in Iran. The capitalist mode of production was introduced by one imperialist force after the other, who had no intentions of developing the country, but would use it for the narrow, specific interests that they had themselves. Most importantly, the development of capitalism in Iran was consolidated, or was made in 1908. Started in 1908 with the discovery of oil in Iran, and thus Iran became a part of the world capitalist system, being a part of the international division of labor, by providing raw materials, especially oil, to the system. So from the early beginnings, the Iranian petty bourgeoisie and the Iranian royal families and aristocracy was completely tied up to the two imperialist domination. This became clear, especially in 1906, where the constitutional revolution of Iran started, which you could say was a bourgeois revolution in Iran, in the fact that it did not solve any of the key questions that the bourgeois revolution needed to solve. There was no land reform, there was no parliament introduced, and in general, the Iranian bourgeoisie, or the petty bourgeoisie, could not introduce any of the measures because the system of capitalism by that point had already gone into a general crisis. It could not afford any concessions to the Iranian masses. And at every single turn of events, the movement of the constitutional revolution broke up in pieces. And it ended up in the dictatorial rule of Reza Shah finally in 1921. And what you can basically say that since the early 1900s, society in Iran has vacillated between two extremes. The society in Iran has swung between two extremes. With the long periods of harsh and black reaction, interrupted by immense revolutionary explosions. And every single time the masses of Iran have risen to power, at every single step they have been confronted with the system of capitalism, and the movement have developed much further than the initial democratic demands that were posed. This has created an incredible revolutionary tradition within the Iranian masses. Actually, not many people know this, but the second Soviet Republic ever set up was in Iran, was in northern Iran, Soviet Republic of Gilan. Also, after World War II, there was a Soviet Republic of Mahabad in the Kurdish areas, and similar embryonic worker states in Azerbaijan as well. But the main problem in every single of these events has been the weakness of the Iranian proletariat to bring the revolution to conclusion. Most of these movements have been led by peasants or other petit bourgeois elements, because the working class did not yet have the strength to join in decisively. But this was drastically changed in the 1979 revolution. Because in the run up to the revolution, there was an enormous economic boom internationally, of course, but also in Iran. From 1960 to 73, the gross national product would rise between 15% and 20% every year. 15% and 20%, which I think not even China can boast of right now. And at the same time, the Shah of Iran was the main ally of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. So this put him in an even better financial position. And throughout this period, what we see is a massive industrialization of Iran. The urban population went from being 30% of the population to being around 50% of the population. And the working class grew massively. In 1975, 40% of adults were workers. And from a Marxist perspective, this is a progressive development, of course. But at the same time, as Marx explained, even in a period of boom, the position of the working class becomes worse. The situation of the working class becomes worse. The workers are pushed into poverty, or they are burdened by incredible exploitation. Which was exactly what happened in Iran as well. In the towns, you would find hundreds of thousands of poor in the slums, living in tin cities. And the factories were completely militarized, with offices of intelligence agency in the most large factories. Of course, unions were outlawed. But whatever union there was, the state union were completely controlled again by the intelligence agency SAVAK. And working hours was from 10 to 14 hours, 6 days a week. And actually, from 1960 to 73, there was a decrease in the share of workers in expenditure for household expenditure. Now, so there was an enormous polarization in society, but not only between the top and lowest layers, but also a differentiation between the top layers and the layers immediately below. The Iranian Shah introduced what he called the White Revolution, which was supposed to take Iran into the new century, modernize Iran. There was a land reform, a so-called land reform. But in fact, what happened was that the Shah was consolidating financial and political power in his own hands. The so-called land reform was used to expropriate and more or less give to the state wide layers of the land of the petty bourgeoisie. And especially the clergy was affected by this, because large amounts of the lands of the mosques were expropriated. At the same time, the Shah attempted to set up his own religious institutions directly connected to the state. Because throughout the history of Iran, the clergy have, of course, been at least the top layers of it have been in defense of the status quo and the ruling classes. But they also had their own independent interests. So by doing this, the Shah pushed a great a majority of the clergy actually into opposition, especially one man known as Khomeini, who represented the most radical wing of the clergy at that time. Now, because of these things, you saw in 1963 mass demonstrations of clerical students erupting in Iran. 1963, that were brutally oppressed, and in the end, Khomeini, who was seen as one of the leaders of this movement, was exiled to Iraq, where he kept writing some opposition things, papers, but mostly focused on narrow religious subjects. Now, at this point, it's important to say that Khomeini's faction within the immense clerical bureaucratic apparatus that all in all had tens of thousands of clerics was not more than 200 people, 200 or 300 maximum. At the same time as attacking the clergy, the Shah also waged a battle against large parts of the bazaar. The bazaar, if anyone here have been to a Middle Eastern country, they or seen Aladdin, they know what the bazaar is. But most importantly, it is the central network of trade in many of these countries. And in Iranian history, the bazaar has also played a very significant political role historically. So the bazaar is the tradesmen of the bazaar were not like the tradespeople you would find in the Wall Street, for instance. Although many times they do the same work. Now the Shah started alienating this layer as well by setting up his own parallel distribution networks, while waging massive anti-corruption and anti-profiteering campaigns against especially the lowest layers of the bazaar. And this created an immense disruption in the workings of the bazaar. By 1977, I think between 1975 and 77, more than 100,000 bazaaris had large fines, have been fined large amounts. Thousands have been imprisoned for profiteering schemes, which no one really points to what was. And there was a stir in the bazaars. It was ferment. Now on top of this situation with polarization all over society, the only way the Shah of Iran could stay in power, the only way any capitalist system has ever been able to stay in power in Iran in the last 100 years, capitalist regime, was through an immense oppression and a vicious oppressive apparatus, especially the SAVAK, the intelligence agency, which had more than 1 million people working for it, played a deadly role against anyone who opposed the system. Thousands of leftist, workers, activists, and Marxists were arrested, imprisoned, or disappeared. And just to explain how vicious this regime was, I remember one time where there was a big wave of executions of mainly leftists and worker activists. What they did was to dig a large grave, a large hole, a big hole, And through several days flying over it with the helicopters and throwing prisoners out. So you can imagine the tensions that were there in society. And while these tensions are going on, the economic crisis, world economic crisis of 73, 74 hits Iran very hard. Inflation rises to 35%. Unemployment rises more than 20%. There's no real statistics. And in Tehran only, the capital, the rents from 75 to 77 rises 300%, just the rent for housing. So this situation intensifies all the contradictions within society and leaves no other way than revolts, more or less. Now, I think listening to these figures, which I don't think could really reflect the real situation, though. But still, I think most people could, at least if they had a working mind, could imagine that something had to happen. And yet the U.S. ambassador, in March of 1978, 10 months before the fall of the Shah, writes President Carter, everything is calm, nothing to be worried about. The Iranian Shah can rule for at least a decade more without any interruptions. Now this should be, I think this person was exceptionally stupid. But this should be a warning to comrades. As we've discussed over this week, more or less, revolutions don't develop as a straight and gradual line. Revolution is a sudden change, a sudden explosion. And if we look at the revolution with the minds of yesterday, with the mentality of yesterday, we will never be able to play any significant role. As I will try to explain, this was the main mistake of more or less all the groups within the workers' movement. The first real mass demonstrations actually started in October 7, 1977, which were initially was protests organized by professors at universities, university students, by poetry associations, writers associations, and also at this stage you begin to see divisions within the ruling class of Iran, As we see in all revolutions, at a certain stage, pressured by the push of the masses, the ruling class divides in two camps, with one of them saying, we need to give concessions from above to avoid revolutions from beneath. And the other camp insists that the only thing that is possible is violent oppression. Now, the ruling class of Iran was not entirely based in Iran. The division came between the Shah of Iran and President Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter argued that focus should be paid to human rights, better conditions should be introduced in the prisons. Although the Americans didn't have any problems with those things the previous 25 years. But what we must understand is that both of these gentlemen were right, and both of them were wrong. At a certain stage, when the qualitative level, the critical point has reached, none of these measures will work. Now, the development of a mass movements actually it was started in 77, but continued in 78 through mass demonstrations. There were mostly funeral processions. Yes. Funeral procession. What do you call it? Like processions. Yes. Funeral processions. At each, every time there was a demonstration, it would be met with brutal force by the Shah, who would open fire on the demonstrators, which would then organize new funeral processions in the period immediately afterwards. Now, you see, this is again the difference between a revolutionary situation and normal times. That as we have seen, for instance, in Tunisia also today, in a revolutionary situation, bullets can have the opposite effect of what they intended to radicalize the masses. Now, in general, the bazaaris, whenever they had protests, mostly it would be confined to the bazaar itself. But under this situation, they used the presence of a mass movement as an excuse to demonstrate for their own needs, demands. And especially because these were, concentrated, centers where people were concentrated in vast numbers, and they could gather a critical mass, the protest of a bazaar was quite successful. Also, to underline the question of the clergy, that was even at that point not in favor of overthrow of the Shah. When the bazaaris went to the, especially in Tehran, when the bazaaris went into the mosques in order to have a legal cover for their demonstrations, the clergy tried to put a brake on the movement, tried to advise them not to protest. To such an extent that Ayatollah Khonsari, who was the main Friday prayers leader in Tehran, could no longer walk without armed police bodyguards in the mosque. But the bazaaris used the mosque as a national means of organizing the protest. And in this way, they linked up also with the lower layers of the clergy, who were indeed radicalized. Because to see the clergy as one block, whether reactionary or progressive, is far away from reality. In all periods in Iranian history, the higher levels, higher layers of the clergy has been completely bound up with the ruling classes, while the lower layers, especially in the rural areas, have lived in absolute poverty. The comrades also mentioned that in regards to the Spanish Revolution, where you saw parts of the church breaking away, and also in 1968, I think there was this movement priests who joined the movement and didn't want to have Sunday mass, etc. So you can see as the mass movement developed, more and more layers were joining in, bringing their own grievances. And at a certain stage in August 1978, the situation became unbearable, and the Shah decided to introduce concessions in order to avoid an overthrow. But you see, by that time it was already too little and too late. What he did, he introduced a new prime minister called Sharif Emami. He freed thousands of political prisoners. Of course, none of them were none of the leftists. He cancelled all the fines that were given to the bazaaris. He pulled the army off the streets, legalized political parties, unions, and introduced the unemployment wage for the first time ever. But in such a situation, these reforms only had the effect of giving more confidence to the movement and opening the road for further crystallization of the movement, for the radicalization of the movement. And you immediately saw a wave of strikes beginning. Workers setting up unions in every single factory and demanding their rights. Because you see, comrades, this is the tricky thing about democracy. That it allows people to actually demand to have a good life. And this showed exactly the limitations of capitalism in Iran. Because within 1 week, they could not tolerate this situation anymore. They declared martial law. The army was put on the streets. And of course, this created a huge response from the masses who came back onto the streets. And on Friday, September 5th, a mass demonstration in Tehran was put down in a bloodbath. Hundreds were killed, thousands were injured. It's called the Bloody Friday, for good reason. But you see, as we have discussed many times, sometimes demonstrations are enough to overthrow a regime, and sometimes they're not. What was needed in Iran, and what we can see throughout the movements we have today, is that the participation of the working class is the key to any revolution. Now, the workers of Iran had not been participating on an organized and independent manner in this movement yet, but the small window of opportunity that opened up in the last days of August allowed them to quickly crystallize immense unions and big organizations. Officially, in the month of September 1979, 35,000 workers struck. 35,000. In September 78, sorry. And every single day, hundreds of new companies would join the strike movement, which was rapidly developing into a general strike. In October, officially again, 120,000 workers struck. And that was only in oil, steel, and railway sectors. In the province of Gilan, which is north of Tehran, the whole province stuck. No company was working. And especially the crushing strike of the oil workers were the key to break the back of the Shah. The strike of the oil workers cost the regime $60 million a day, and which is in itself a very large amount in 1979. But more importantly, it put pressure on the world market. And forced the allies of Iran to start withdrawing their support. Khomeini at that time, who was living in Iraq, was exiled from Iraq and was accepted in France. And the airtime of French television and BBC and most big television networks were freed up completely and left to his disposal. The movement of the workers was shaking the whole foundations of society, and the strategists of world imperialism was terrified, and they would do anything to save the capitalism in Iran, and because they knew also that the traditions of the Iranian workers movement was completely revolutionary. Of all the workers leaders, the majority, of course, were in a sense apolitical, but 35% said they were Marxists. 35%. And in fact, the reformist organizations have never been able to sink roots within Iranian society, because any attempt to gain any reforms would put you in direct confrontation with the state and the regime in itself. The traditional party of the Iranian working class was a old Communist Party, the Tudeh Party, and although by that time it had lost great authority, it was clear that it played a big role there. Now, of course, a general strike and an independent movement of the workers is very important for a revolution, is crucial for a revolution, but also a general strike without an uprising is not that effective. It could go into itself again. Because, as I think Trotsky said, the general strike poses the question of power, but does not solve it. Now, at the end of December, at the early December, a mass uprising started taking shape. Millions of people were on the streets on a daily basis, more or less. Between 10th and 11th of December, up to 9 million people were on the street. In a country of 50 million, you can imagine that what impact this must have had. Yes. Now, what I think is really important with the question of the workers in this revolution, first of all, it shows, of course, the strength of the working class that is able to cut all lines of supply to the regime. But also, I think it's really important to all the, well, both the sectarians and the opportunists that do not trust the working class. That the strike was actually led by the oil workers, who were seen as the privileged sections of the Iranian working class. They were called the labor aristocracy, receiving relatively high wages, and had well far better conditions than any other working class section in Iran. And actually, when you read the interviews with the workers conducted during the revolution, what they say is that they didn't strike for the immediate demands that they put up there, actually, which were a bit more than 50% of the demands were economic demands for better wages, etc. But they say that they used these demands as an excuse to legitimize the strikes and to join the general movement against oppression in solidarity with the people of Iran. And what happened in those days were really incredible. For instance, the railway workers refused to, even though all their demands were met, refused to go back to work, because they knew that the railways were going to be used to send troops to put down the demonstrations. And this is what we saw in everywhere, basically. In the 6 months before, from June till December of 1978, average wages of workers rose by 25%. But this did not stop the strikes. On the contrary, the strikes broadened and became more and more radicalized, more and more bold. Another interesting example is a steelworks in the center of Iran, who struck on October 7th, and then the army sent in hundreds of troops occupying the factory. They continued to strike. At the end, about a week later, they had to turn to work on the situation of siege, with armed soldiers by every machine. But what they did then was to send delegations to other steelworks and to prepare that on January 12th, the whole steel industry of Iran put down tools. In every single factory, workers' committees sprung up, taking over. The oil industry was under the complete control of the oil workers' committee. And it was clear that although the revolution at that point was still in a democratic phase, that the workers had no intentions of stopping with gaining formal democratic rights. At that time already, the workers were pushing against, were moving towards taking over the factories. And they even started coordinating the works of the factories in one sense, embryonic way, but in another sense, on a large scale. For instance, the steel complex in Isfahan needed coal to keep the smelters hot, and they made a deal with the railway union and the miners' committees to get coal transported across the country. Also, the refineries and the oil workers wanted to get oil for domestic use. And again, on a national basis, they made a deal with the railway workers to distribute this on a nationwide scale. Now, the bourgeois could see which way this was developing. And I think it was in mid-January the main imperialist powers of Germany, France, the U.S., and I think even Russia, Soviet Union at that time, or not, it doesn't really matter. They met in Guadalupe. They had the famous Guadalupe Congress, and they decided to officially back the Khomeini in his bid to take power. Now, this should be there's proof again that for anyone who says that Khomeini was an anti-imperialist, this should really expose these things. A deal was struck with Khomeini, and a deal was struck with the army to remain passive. And of course, they didn't have a choice. Thousands of soldiers have had escaped from the barracks. Hundreds of soldiers had committed suicide or shot their officers when told to shoot at the protesters. And any move by the army would have ended in dissolution of the army. And finally, on February 12th, the uprising reached such a level that the masses stormed the barracks of the armed forces, helped by two small guerrilla organizations at that time, the Mujahideen and the Fedayeen. They took over. 2 days later, Khomeini returned, and 8 million people welcomed him. This was a genuine people's revolution, as I said to begin. But the masses who were at the airport to welcome Khomeini were not there to demand Sharia law. They were not there to demand veils or for the state to be merged with religious institutions. They were there to demand bread and jobs, decent life, respect, democracy. This was what they were fighting for. And at this point, Khomeini had not said anything else but this. Khomeini was a populist character, and he had to go to enormous lengths to connect with the mass movement in Iran. The nationalizations of the vast industries. What bourgeois would accept this? There's a very interesting situation that tells you something about the mood of the masses in those days. There was a big demonstration in Tehran, hundreds of thousands of people, and they passed by the central bank, who was on strike, of course, and they had just revealed that the Shah had been channeling billions of dollars out of the country in the last 6 months. And one of the workers of the central bank comes out of the window and shouts, "The banks must be nationalized." So the whole demonstration starts chanting, "The banks must be nationalized." And this becomes one of the main demands of the movement from then on. Some people on the left try to portray Khomeini as a leftist who went astray or something like that. But in fact, at that time, the counter-revolution had no other possibility than to take on the demands of the movement. And they nationalized the majority of Iranian industry and all the banks. And foreign exchange, is that what it's called? They made a state monopoly of foreign trade, which were not the demands and slogans of the clergy, but of the masses. Now, by the time this regime of the Shah fell, many people say that was the revolution. But in fact, when we look closely at it, that was only the beginning. Because the workers had the right to speak now, right to assemble. Now they also wanted a job. They also wanted bread. And so there was a massive radicalization. And the workers' organizations grew at a very rapid pace. The 2 day, which was very discredited because of its Stalinist policies, grew to have hundreds of thousands of supporters, and the Fedayeen also, which participated in the uprising, who had only between 100 and 200 members prior to the revolution, within 9 months, grew to have at least this is what they say, 2 million sympathizers, 2 million people they could mobilize, and thousands of members. But the main problem with the, all of the workers' organizations, all the left organizations, all the sects, and all the Stalinists was that they didn't understand the character of capitalist society in Iran. They failed to understand the character of the movement. And they failed at every important turn, at every important step. The 2 day only in late January said that this was a revolutionary situation, proclaimed that this was a revolution. But even then, they would not admit how far the revolution could go. The main theory of the Tudeh was a Menshevik theory of two stages. They said this is a bourgeois democratic revolution, a national democratic revolution. So what we must do is to support the progressive bourgeoisie, which I don't know. I mean, no one has ever found this progressive bourgeoisie. They all look for it. And to help them consolidate a capitalist society in Iran, a modern capitalist society. But what we have to understand is that capitalism in Iran was never able to give any further concessions to them. This was the best they could give. A brutal dictatorship at the height of an economic boom. Now, and the way that the Tudeh reacted towards the clergy, in my opinion, is key to understanding the situation and why events developed as they did, was because they saw the clergy as one single block, one solid, homogeneous block. While the clergy and the bazaaris and all these layers were parts of the middle class, whose higher layers had the same interests as the ruling classes, and whose lower layers could be won over to the working class. But only insofar as it developed that the working class developed an independent stance. But what the leaders of the Tudeh and following them, all the other organizations were saying, openly, was that the working class must submit to this to the petty bourgeoisie. This was what they stated, black on white. Although these elements themselves were attacking workers' organizations and workers' demonstrations way before the revolution. You know, Comrade Allen likes to quote the Bible. And I think it's from the Bible where it says, "Eyes they have, but they do not see." And this could not be a better explanation. This could not be a better explanation of the situation in the workers' organizations at the leadership. It was clear that Khomeini's faction was moving to secure power on a reactionary basis. Besides attacking workers' organizations, they had vast anti-communist propaganda and agitation. One of the main demands for the workers' committees in the factories was Islamic committees, of course, which was to have no communists and no socialists. In spite of this, the Tudeh said, no, these are anti-imperialists, progressive bourgeoisie, etc., etc. On the other hand, the ultra lefts, who also had a few organizations, were denouncing the middle class movement, proclaiming the clergy and the bazaaris to be one reactionary bloc, which was proved to be wrong again and again. One organization, which is one of the better organizations, it's probably the one closest to us, had a theory explaining the clergy as a reactionary caste. And this is this mistake is just as grave as by accepting the all of the petty bourgeoisie as a leader of the, because it cuts off the advanced layers of the workers from the movement, from the mass of the movement, and it hands over the leadership to Khomeini. Well, that's what they did. And you see, they had clean hands. They were never in bed with Khomeini, but they were never with the workers either, or the mass of Iranian revolutionaries. What was needed was to have a clear independent stance, exposing every single reactionary move of the clergy and of the official leadership of the movement, while being in the movement, being in the committees, being in every single place where the masses were struggling. But you see, despite the many mistakes of these organizations, the working class of Iran was not going to wait for anyone to help it. It was already continuing the fight. There was not a day's pause in the movement. Just in the month after the revolution, there was 50,000 strikes, taking over factories and de facto nationalizing them, pushing the regime to do it in a legal manner. And at each step, the movement was confronted by the by the new ruling clique, by the Khomeini and the liberals who he was in coalition with. And they fought back. On 8th of March, a few days before 8th of March, Khomeini decreed that a veil was mandatory. And on 8th of March, thousands, hundreds of thousands of women poured into the streets protesting against this. In the end of April, just before May Day, you had a demonstration of 300,000 unemployed. And on May Day, you had the biggest May Day celebrations ever in the history of Iran. 2 million people demonstrated in Tehran only. And you see, today the most honest Stalinists from that time say, well, we didn't have the forces to overthrow Khomeini. But on May Day, the balance of forces were very clear. Khomeini had to come out, had to call for a demonstration, and use all the channels of all state channels to do this. He raised minimum wage as a populist way of getting people. But in spite of this, there was four demonstrations. One with 500,000 people supporting Khomeini. One with 500,000 people supporting the Mujahideen Islamic guerrilla organizations, which were also moving to the left. And two demonstrations also with 500,000 each, with the organized by the Stalinist organizations, the communist organizations, the trade unions. And the vast majority of the trade unions were supporting these two organizations, these two demonstrations. But this is not the end of it. I mean, the most important development that happened after the revolution was in the factories, because as soon as the regime fell, an immense power vacuum opened up. And at the same time, just as we see in Egypt and Tunisia today, there was a great class differentiation taking place. So the workers took over the factories and ran them by themselves. The oil industry was under the complete control of the workers' committees. And although all foreign specialists had been expelled from the country, and all of the top of the oil companies had also escaped, the company was running perfectly well. And I should actually mention one very interesting fact about the oil workers, who 3 weeks before the uprising declared that there was a new form of oppression that was beginning to take shape under the guise of religion. And so there was a bitter struggle for more than 6 months between the oil workers who wanted to remain in control of the industry and the state, who from the beginning tried to impose its own domination of it and tried to push out the workers' councils. Again, the movement was so strong that the regime had to take in some of the demands of the workers and created a central body of workers' committees. Again, this is a great tragedy of the Iranian Revolution. Because of these committees that were literally controlling every single branch of industry in Iran, had been linked up on a proletarian basis, it could have taken power like this. There was nothing that could stop them. Instead, all the major workers' organizations defended Khomeini against the workers when he ordered the workers to go back to work, proclaiming it counter-revolutionary. I think it's a term we've heard before. And these committees were not just committees of workers' control. In some areas, they took over the running of the whole areas. At the same time, a vast movement of neighborhood committees started, in the same sense that we see in Egypt and Tunisia today, but on a far greater scale, covering all of Tehran, the capital, which was the most important city, and who took care of distribution of food, fuel, all of the basic needs. And also what they did was to organize the occupation of houses that were left, palaces that were left by the aristocracy, the Shah's family. But But again, instead of for the workers' organizations, especially the Stalinist ones, instead of giving a lead to this, instead of giving a perspective for this and linking this up on a national basis, they did absolutely nothing. Now there's a I talked with one of the participants, actually a leading middle layer leading activist in the Tudeh party at that time he was. And he told me about how the Tudeh activists would go into these committees and help all the homeless people get settled in these big palaces. And of course they were all from rural areas, so they would have goats and walking in the middle of these great extravagant palaces. But at a certain stage, when it was decreed that the committees were to become Islamic committees, meaning, in effect, meaning that the class context to be taken out of them, they were made mere perks for the new developing state bureaucracy. The housing were becoming a perk for the developing state bureaucracy, like perks, you know, privilege, giving it to their friends and cousins. And in regard to the workers' committees, what was the main campaign of the Tudeh? I think this is important to mention. Instead of campaigning for them to be linked up on a regional and national basis, they campaigned to make them into unions, trade unions, economic trade unions. This was the impasse that the revolution had gone into. It was a dead end. And there was no other force to take the lead from there. I think I can talk for hours about how many committees were in the army and the universities everywhere. But then you see these Stalinists, they say, well, you know, we may have had the working class, which was only 40% of the population, but we didn't have the petty bourgeoisie and the masses. We didn't have Khomeini had them because they were backward. And there's some truth to this, but there's also a reason. And as soon as the revolution developed, the Iran, which is compiled of 11 nationalities, was also taken by national struggles for autonomy. In fact, even though all the sects and the Stalinists was writing the nationalities off and demanding from them to be, you know, to stay within the confines of Iran, I had a very nationalist approach to these movements. None of the national movements in Iran developed into independence movements, actually. I think the most important struggle there was in the Kurdish areas, who have great revolutionary traditions, even though it's quite non-industrial compared to the rest of Iran. And the Kurds, there was a massive spontaneous occupation of land, expropriation of land by the peasants and by the poor. Shuras, or Soviet-type organizations sprang up, controlling vast areas. And of course, Khomeini could not, the government could not allow this. So there was a pact, there was an alliance with the landowners, the landlords from the previous regime, and the Khomeiniites, within 6 months to wage a military campaign against the Kurdish areas. And over the next next 3 years, through several attempts, they completely devastated these areas, killing thousands of people. And what was the response of the Tudeh? And I have to say, I'm quoting Tudeh a lot because although they were not the biggest organization, they were the defining organization. They were defining the line for all the other ones. What they said to the first attack was, we want a fair solution, and if there's not found a solution to the crisis, which has also started in Khuzestan, in the Arab areas, the counter-revolution might find an inroad. Then it goes on blaming all the leftist parties in Kurdistan for this attack, saying they provocated the attack. And they are forcing the regime to spend money on arms instead of people. Of course, it also criticizes the Islamic Republic because it's buying tanks from America to use in these campaigns. Because the regime is buying tanks from America in this campaign, using American tanks. So you can see how the leaders were openly betraying the movement and had many chances of winning these over. The same thing happened in the Turkmen areas in the north, where there was a shura, a Soviet of 300,000 people who had occupied all the land, expropriated all the land, and that was put down in a bloodbath by the regime. The same in the Arab areas, where hundreds of thousands took the streets, only wanting autonomy, not independence. And similar things happened all over Iran. At every single step, the Stalinist organizations mainly would criticize the masses for trying to go beyond the democratic revolution. And the sects would denounce the whole thing because the masses were infected by the petty bourgeois policies and Stalinist policies of the Stalinists. In effect, finally in 1980, the situation has also changed in the universities. In 1979, the Islamic parties had more than 2/3 of the votes in the universities. But by 1980, the influence has completely evaporated, and they had no active branches in universities. So Khomeini, as a Bonapartist as he is, closes the universities. Khomeini decrees the closure of all universities for 2 years because they're westernized. And the workers' organizations do absolutely nothing against this. Finally, in April, you know, in spite of all these betrayals, the movement does develop. Leaders arise from the bottom. And the workers try to push the movement further. Of course, the main weakness was the lack of a national alternative, a national organization to put this on an organized basis. But still in 1980 and 81, they're still pushing further. And this is spilling over, the revolution is spilling over into Iraq especially. In the southern parts of the Shia, Shia population in Iraq, they start to protest against the Saddam regime. And in the northern parts, the Kurds. So in April 1980, Saddam Hussein starts an attack against Iran, a military campaign against Iran, which officially was about a bit of territory with oil. But in effect, it was an attack against the revolution itself. And this should be a basic understanding for Marxists, people who call themselves Marxists. From what I heard from the French Revolution in this week, I didn't know before, it's quite clear that this is an old trick. But instead of taking an independent proletarian stance, which was completely possible at that time, because the embryonic organs of workers' power had developed to a certain extent and could be developed in that situation. Instead, all the organizations put the thrust behind the Khomeini's state apparatus, which in the beginning was in a very weak state, but that is now given a chance to develop. The left helped Khomeini build the monster, the military monster that's going to crush themselves later on. In my opinion, a revolutionary war in that situation against Iraq would have been a victorious one. If you grant autonomy to the Kurds, to the Shias, expropriate the land, you would have a million-man army on the other side of the border. But instead, the Stalinists go in defense of the Iranian nation. You see, comrades, there are many instances like this where the workers' leaders play a reactionary role in regards to the movement. I don't have time to go into all of them. There are many more. But in effect, through the years, from 79 to 83, the movement ebbs. And of course it does so. No one can be in a situation of tense mobilization for a prolonged period. I mean, And one by one, Khomeini leans on different layers to crush the others. Firstly, with the late 79 and early 80s, he leans on the workers' organizations to crush the liberals and the petty bourgeoisie from the bazaar, who is always portrayed as his best friends and allies till the end. But in reality, in the end, the only alliance he had was with the absolute top crust of the bazaaris. Then he crushes the national movements, the student movement, and one by one the workers' organizations, who for the biggest of them continued defending him until the end. In the years of 82, 83, hundreds of people get executed every day. Thousands of people are put in prison. And finally, in 1983, the two-day is outlawed. And at the same time, it is clearly stressed that the right to private property is the right given by God. This should clarify what the real matter was about. Now, despite all of this, the war between Iran and Iraq continued for 8 years, and not a single dot on the border changes. They just stand shooting it. It strengthens the straight apparatus that Khomeini is building. It derails the movement in effect. And it is clearly supported by all the imperialist and forces and the Soviet Union, who are selling arms to both camps. I mean, it was not uncommon to see in the Portuguese ports to see Iranian and Iraqi warships next to each other being repaired and getting ready to go fight against each other. Of course, the West was not interested in... of course, the imperialists wanted to defend capitalism. And the Soviet Union was terrified of a development of a healthy workers' state in Iran. This was the whole basis of the theory of stages of the progressive bourgeoisie, etc. And finally, when the movement has ebbed completely, and all that's left is the scum, is the leftovers, the rotten petty bourgeois, the rotten elements in the slums of the cities, basing himself on these layers, Khomeini orders a mass execution of thousands of workers' leaders and revolutionaries who were in the prisons. That was in July 1988 or August 1988. Within the space of 2 days, 12,000 people are murdered. The trials are less than 10 minutes long. And where they ask if they are Muslims or not Muslims, communists or not communists, and if they answer the wrong question, of course they are executed immediately. But the significance of this event is not the immediate happenings, but it's a fact that you can say that the workers' movement is beheaded and is left completely disoriented. And in my opinion, solely 100%. The responsibility of the Stalinists and the sectarian leaders that were in Iran at that time, who had every single chance to win over the majority. They could win over the nationalities, they could win over the youth, they already had the workers, the women, and the fact that, you see, opportunists and sectarians look at the revolution in a formalist way, in a static manner. They say, oh, these organizations, they had a lot of members, so we could never have won. We only had 50,000, they had 500,000. But the social weight of the proletariat is 1,000 times stronger, heavier than any other class. And if it moves decisively and in a united manner, it can break the petty bourgeoisie in two. How many members did the SRs have in the Russian Revolution? I think they had many more than the Bolsheviks. I don't remember the figures right now. But the Bolsheviks, by moving decisively, broke off the bottom layers of the petty bourgeoisie and won them over to the revolution. Now, the theoretical mistake was to think that it is possible to build a democratic bourgeois democracy in a time of capitalist decay and general crisis of capitalism in a backwards semi-colonial country. Now the proof is quite evident. None of the fundamental issues have been solved. The oppression have gotten worse. And today we see the results of that is the beginning of a new movement. But you see, as we have also talked a lot about in this in the present week, the world situation today is quite different. Besides the huge growth of the working class, all the Stalinist organizations and all the reformist organizations are in a huge crisis, in a big crisis. And especially the Stalinists cannot play that role of the break that they did in the past. So, comrades, I think this was my lead-off. I think the Iranian Revolution, not because I'm interested in it myself only, but it should be studied in detail, because it was one of the strongest mass movements in the last 50 or 60 years. It was fundamentally a proletarian movement that moved against the foundations of capitalism. And it showed the initiative of the working class fighting against all odds. Of course, it ended in a defeat. But in the last week, we have discussed almost nothing but defeats. But as Rosa Luxemburg said, for us, the defeats are the breeding ground of tomorrow's victories. Thank you, comrades.